As the usual way of Dr. Peter, he's done an absolutely amazing job of trying to fit the whole purport or the whole translation. How he does this is just amazing. His writing is just fantastic, you know. So anyway, okay, so here we go. Kvachit pibayutam pibati. Pibati cham pibati. Madri ram madavi vala. Asnanyam kachit ashnati. Yakshatyam saha yakshiti. Kvachit pipantyam pipati. Mariram madavivala. Asnatyam kvachit ashnati. Yakshatyam saha yakshitai. Kvachit pipantyam pipati. Madriram madavivala. Ashnatyam kachit ashnati. Yakshatyam saha yakshiti. So, as I said, there are a number of different verses.
Can I put that there? All right.
I think I have them.
Yeah, it's just too much to go through the translation, so I'll just read the translation. And there are five verses here that we're doing. So, for that, is the video now working?
Yeah,
it's okay. So for those that have just joined us, it's Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 25, verses 57 to 61. And this is the translation. When the queen drank liquor, King Puranjana also engaged in drinking. When the queen dined, he used to dine with her. And when she chewed, King Puranjana used to chew along with her. When the queen sang, he also sang. Similarly, when the queen cried, he also cried. And when the queen laughed, he also laughed. When the queen talked loosely, he also talked loosely. And when the queen walked, the king walked behind her. When the queen would stand still, the king would also stand still. And when the queen would lie down in bed, he would also follow and lie down with her. When the queen sat, he would also sit. And when the queen heard something, he would follow her to hear the same thing. When the queen saw something, the king would also look at it. And when the queen smelled something, the king would also follow her to smell the same thing. When the queen touched something, the king would also touch it. And when the dear queen was lamenting, the poor king also had to follow in her lamentation. In the same way, when the queen felt enjoyment, he also enjoyed. And when the queen was satisfied, the king also felt satisfaction. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The mind is the place where the self is situated, and the mind is conducted by the intelligence. The living entity, situated within the heart, follows the intelligence. The intelligence is herein depicted as the queen, and the soul, under mental control, follow the material intelligence just as the king follows his wife. Conclusion is that the material intelligence is the cause of bondage for the living entity. The point that one has to take to spiritual intelligence is to come out of this entanglement. In the life of Maharaj Ambarish, we find that the great Maharaj first engaged his mind in the lotus feet of Krishna. In this way, his intelligence became purified. Maharaj Ambarish also used to use his other senses in the service of the Lord. He engaged his eyes in seeing the deities in the temple, nicely decorated with flowers. He engaged his sense of smell by smelling the flowers, he engaged his legs by walking to the temple. His hands were engaged in cleansing the temple, and his ears were engaged in hearing about Krishna. His tongue was engaged in two ways, in speaking about Krishna and in tasting prasadam offered to the deity. Materialistic persons who are under the full control of material intelligence cannot perform all these activities. Thus, consciously or unconsciously, they become entangled by the dictations of material intelligence. This fact is summarized in the following verse. Amagana timidanda sya gananjana shalakaya chakshuram militam nena tasma shri guruen maha vanchakalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhupayevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasati Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So here we see this poor king Puranjana being following his lovely queen around. So again, as we understand, Narad Muni has placed this story before us. It's an allegory. It is a way that we can learn something through a story. And even in the Christian world, back in the 15th century, they would also do these allegorical stories. One that comes to mind is, it's called the Everyman Play. Has anybody ever heard of this, the Everyman Play? The Everyman Play, the central character is a flawed individual. Right? This is how it's, I'll read out what it was. It's a morality play. So in the past, the Christians would also have these sort of stories to enlighten people or enliven people to take up devotional service, to take up some sort of spiritual life. So the morality plays were in particularly very popular in the 15th and 16th century. And they used an allegorical story to teach a moral message. This is exactly this what Narad Muni is doing here with King Prachanabhari. And it is underpinned by Christian values and Christian teachings. The character personified abstract qualities of goodness, evil, virtue and vice, which engaged in a battle with the soul of mankind figure. After giving to the temptation of worldly pleasure and sin, the respective human repented and was saved just in time to go to heaven. So this is the story. It was about this guy who, representing all of humanity, is struggling with the forces of material nature and the mind and intelligence to actually live a positive Krishna conscious, God conscious life. So that was very important. There's also another story, again in the Christian tradition, which is possibly the second most popular book ever written. What do you think the most popular book that was ever written is, especially in the Western world?
The Bible.
The Bible, yeah, exactly. What do you think the second most popular book is in the Western world? Any idea? No? Has anybody ever heard of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan? Mm. Yeah? The Pilgrim's Progress is a similar sort of allegorical story about a guy who's living in a very oppressed sort of situation, and through this book that someone has left him, he actually gets an opportunity to search for freedom, to search for enlightenment. And it's a staging where he goes through different stages to find salvation, to find himself, to find out who he really is and how he connects with God. So this is The Pilgrim's Progress. And so it's a hugely popular book, it has been. Obviously, as Kali Yuga is progressing, it's becoming less and less popular, but I noticed recently that there was a cartoon presentation of The Pilgrim's Progress now available that was done by some Christian group. And again, the story is there. It's about material life and how we should break the shackles of material life and follow a life of devotion. So it's interesting that even in the Christian tradition they do this. Now we used to, as devotees, and so these plays were usually done in a public setting. It would be in the marketplace or not necessarily even in a hall or somewhere where people would be doing plays and everything. So it would be done in a marketplace where people would gather, and all of a sudden these actors would come together and they would do these stories. So back in the early days of Krishna consciousness, we used to do that as well. So if you would go out on Harinam, all of a sudden you'd stop the Harinam and you would do this little play. And people were fascinated by that. People were really enthralled. What the hell's going on here? You know, all of a sudden there's this play happening. Like the bird in the cage, you know. Like a devotee would come out and have a cage with like a puppet dead bird, right? And he would sing out, look at my cage, look at my cage. You know, and then another devotee would go, yeah, but the bird is dead. Yes, but my cage is really beautiful. Look at how well I've done the cage. It's gold plated. And people would be like, what's this guy on about? And then the story would be, you know, that it's, if you're decorating your body and you're not feeding the soul within, then what's the point of it all? So these were quick sort of plays that we did. And it attracts people. It gets people in. And they become enthralled by the actual acting, and they also become enthralled by the message that you're getting across. And it's all about getting a message across. See, Narad Muni here is a very intelligent person, and he knew that King Pachadevari would not be able to take the message straight off. Hey mate, you're too attached to your wife. And you know, it's like, what? Get out. So he did this allegorical story to sort of convince Pachadevari that actually, have a close look at yourself. You know, this is not the way to go. And so through this story, slowly, slowly leads the king to a path of self-realization. So all the great teachers in the world have done this. There was another one. Yeah, we used to do it also at the Sunday feast programs. You know, all of a sudden we would pop up and have a play, you know. One that we used to do, which was really interesting, it was so funny. We used to say, you know, people would be having prasadam or something like that, and then all of a sudden I'd walk in a sort of a John Cleese sort of way. Anybody know John Cleese from Monty Python? Anyway, okay. I would come in as a John Cleese sort of person, and there would be this guy sitting there, you know, an innocent sort of person. He was switched on as to what was happening, but nobody else would be. And so I'd come in and say, good evening, everyone. It's time to pay your air tax. And the guys, everybody go, what the hell's going on? Who's this guy? And then I'd pick on this bloke who was obviously in the know. He was also an actor. And I says, so, Mr. John, whatever your name is, Mr. John Bloke, it's time to pay your air tax. And he goes, what do you mean? What do you mean? Pay my air tax. You know, and then he'd say, well, you didn't think you got your air for nothing, did you? You know, and then they went on about the whole thing about that everything is coming from the Lord, and somehow or other, you have a duty of care because you're renting this body. It is not your body, and it goes into a whole... Man, at this stage, everybody's like, stopped eating. What the hell is going on here, you know? And so then, well, you know, if you don't want to pay your air tax, I'll have to cut it off. And they go, what? So I open up my briefcase and I've got this noose, you know, like a hangman's noose. And I slip it around his head and I said, time to pay your air tax. And if you're not paying, then we'll have to stop the air supply, you know. And then a devotee bursts in. Wait, 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 you know. If he becomes a devotee and renders service to Krishna, is that paying tax? Yes, of course. Everyone has to pay tax to Krishna. And then the message is hit home, you know. So those sort of things were spontaneous, but they were very effective. You know, like people would be here for the first time to Krishna consciousness and they were thinking, what the? You know, but it stuck with them. It stuck with them. The play actually stuck with them. The first time I came to the temple, one of the first times I came to the temple, and they did the stomach, you know, where there's the revolt that they're not going to feed the stomach anymore. You know that play? And I remember they got this red sleeping bag, and Korma was the stomach. And he was wrapped in this red sleeping bag, so he was the stomach, you know. So I never forget that, you know. So plays are really, really important. And in the 80s, 70s, or 80s in particular, and 90s a little bit, when I was a bit younger, we used to do a lot of plays, at least 3 or 4 plays a year. and they all had some sort of a little twist to make people think about God consciousness and Krishna consciousness. So anyway, recently Bhakti and I went to New Govardhan, and we used to do plays like The Buried Treasure, which was all about, you know, Treasure Island, you know, and finding this illusory gold, and now I'm wealthy, and the pirates and everything. And then we had another one which was called I Am the One, about a pop star who thinks that he's so great. Another one was Hansel and Gretel. We did a whole story on Hansel and Gretel. So anyway, the thing was, this was back in the early 80s. And in the early 80s, the Gurukul kids would sit around and they were like glued to these plays, because it's even more exciting than a video or a cartoon, because they're actual people, you know, and it was interactive. And sometimes you'd do a scary thing like in Hansel and Gretel. Aniruddha Prabhu was the wicked witch called Maya. And we did him up in such a way that, I mean, you just couldn't pick it was Aniruddha. And he was horrible, you know. He had a big long nose. Have you seen that one? No? Had a big long nose and a black hat. And he was hunched over and he'd go, "My little darlings!" You know, and the kids were sitting in the front and they were absolutely petrified. You know, and he would go up to them and go, "Do you want to have some of my gingerbread?" You know, and I'd be freaking out. "No, no." So anyway, Bhakti and I went to New Govardhan recently, and these little kids are now adults with their own kids. And they said, "You know, Bhakti Prabhu, I still remember those plays that you guys did. They had such a profound effect on my life that they really made me think about Krishna consciousness in a different way." So these plays are actually such a vital, powerful way to get a message across. And Narad Muni is actually, this whole section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is showing the power of these this play. And it's basically a story, you know. So there's another one, actually. This is called Faust. Anybody ever heard of Faust by Goethe?
Goethe.
Faust is, again, the same sort of thing where this guy... Is this working?
The sound is...
Do I need anything with this, or... Can I put that here, or...
Probably.
Okay. Is that any better for everybody? Sorry, Bruce. Okay. So the other one is Faust by Goethe. Goethe. And that's based on, again, back in the 16th century, it was a Christian sort of play. And this was a story about a guy similar to King Paranjana who wanted this beautiful woman, but he was old. His body had aged. And he was thinking, how am I ever going to be attractive to this young woman who he fell in love with, you know? And so then the devil comes. And it's an opera, actually, also. It's a play and it's also an opera.
There's two operas. The Juno opera is to be the most famous in the world.
That's the one, right? Yeah. And then there's the other one as well.
Which is by... there's one by Berlioz, and there's an Italian composer too. There were three casts.
Anyway, the basic storyline is that, you know, he's somehow or other really desiring material enjoyment. And then from the stage, from the bottom of the stage, this devil figure comes up. There's a whole lot of smoke, and this devil comes up, and in a big, deep voice, "Oh, you know, like the whole opera sort of thing. And he comes and he tells this poor, innocent person that if you want this beautiful woman, and you want wealth, and you want everything, then you have to surrender your soul to me. You have to give me your soul. So that means he's captivated by material lusts completely, you know. And so he does. And consequently, all the miseries that permeate from that. So this Faust, which was a story back in the 16th century, has been continuously being shown in different operas and everything. And believe it or not, it's being shown again in Melbourne. And it started yesterday, I think, in the Regent Theatre. And so this whole opera on Faust, about how the devil is swaying this person from devotional life, is again being professed. So there's still so much interest. There's still interest in this sort of thing. So in the same way, this allegorical story of Puranjana is supposed to give both King Pratinibharaji a message. He wants a message. And it's like that every man play or every person play. It is not necessarily just for the male sector of the population. It is for both the male and female association. This is a way of understanding that we all have to become Krishna conscious. And sometimes we have to present our message in a particular way that is attractive to people. So in Krishna consciousness, one of the things as far as growing in Krishna consciousness is we have to start to learn how to actually present the message of Krishna consciousness so people find it palatable. Just like Narad Muni did with King Pratinibhari, he told the story of Puranjana in a way that will influence him, that will entice him to actually live a better life. So in the same way, I remember in the early days in Krishna consciousness, when we first received this wonderful knowledge, we were very enthusiastic, but sometimes you'd be over-enthusiastic, and at a restaurant or in a preaching situation, you would give people the full source straight away. You know, you're not this material body. You're actually, you should follow these principles. No illicit sex, no gambling. What, you have sex, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It's like, so we had to moderate how we present Krishna consciousness. And that's a question of becoming mature and understanding and learning. How can I present this message to other people in a way that doesn't turn them off and encourages them to actually become devotees? So there's an art to that. And you have to learn how to do that. And you have to suss out the person that you're speaking to and how to deal with that person and deal in a way that won't offend them immediately but encourage them. And in Krishna consciousness, what do we simply want a person to do? The basic thing that we want a person to do is what? Anyone? Huh? Chant. Try chanting. The first thing, our person, like when we do the Bhagavad Gita card readings, right? And the person comes to us and they've got so much misery, they've got this, they've got that. The simple thing is, look, have you ever tried this japa meditation to chant Hare Krishna, you know? So that's the first thing. That one, and the second thing is what? Prasad. Two big things. Chanting, prasad. So if you can get a person to chant Hare Krishna, and you get a person to offer prasad, offer their food to Krishna, and that doesn't mean that necessarily a person has to straight away do, you know, the whole arati and offering like that. Even if in the early days they can just remember before they take their meal. And we encourage vegetarianism, which has to be make people understand that, you know, a vegetarian diet is what Krishna likes. There's no violence in that. And that we have to offer our food like that. So they're the basic prominent things that we have to present to a person. And then, as a person advances and grows, then we can actually add more things to it. So this is important. So Narad, the story of Narad Muni, In another sense, we've heard, and Gangeshwara was giving a wonderful class yesterday, we've heard about this queen where the king is following the queen around all the time. And so this story is not a story downing women at all. And some people may perceive it as that, you know, that this is somehow or other minimizing women or that women are a source of enticement. In fact, what it represents is the material. The woman, queen, represents material intelligence, which is applicable to all of us. We're all affected by material intelligence, as well as men and women, and we should utilize the mind to actually grow in Krishna consciousness. And this is supported in Prabhupada's purport. So this story is meant for everyone. Now, the issue arises sometimes, which has been discussed at times within our movement, the role and position of women within ISKCON and the broader community, and it can be at times controversial. Gangeshwara Prabhu was mentioning yesterday, you know, that we have to be very sensitive in this area. So there's, you're no doubt aware that there is the whole women are advocating that they should also be Diksha Gurus. That's now part of our tenets of ISKCON, especially in the Western world, but there's still controversy in that. And when I do my interfaith work, that's one of the big criterias. You know, people ask me, in Krishna consciousness, are men and women equal in every way? And I said, yes, we're very much so. A woman can do anything that a man can do, as far as deity worship, anything. They can become priests. And sometimes my colleagues in other traditions, excuse me, they find it really astounding that actually we're so advanced that we allow women to be priests and everything, because in the Christian tradition, especially the Catholic tradition, women are still not allowed to be priests. They can't do the sacred sacrifices. In the Jewish tradition also, it's only the less orthodox that allow women to become rabbis. And so they're astounded. And so they also ask very often, can women become spiritual masters, teachers? And now we can wholeheartedly say that, yes, women can also become spiritual teachers. So there's this controversy. And sometimes also there's controversy as far as some of the passages within Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, which may be confusing to some people as far as minimizing the importance of women and so on and so forth. So the thing that must be remembered is that we're all coming from a very checkered past. Before we became devotees, we were all in a demoniac sort of understanding. And being in ISKCON for a number of years, we're still slowly getting out of that material sort of consciousness, that demoniac sort of consciousness, and becoming more saintly. It's a cleansing process. Krishna consciousness is a cleansing process. So we've all been, this is the one thing that people sometimes forget, because we understand reincarnation, we have all been both men and women in different lifetimes. So we've all had a chance to be male or female, so it's not a big deal. In this lifetime, if you're in a woman's body, that's your lot. If you're in a man's body, that's your lot. So, and basically, again, as Prabhupada has pointed out in so many places, we are living in a night and day dream. Sometimes you may have a dream, and in that dream, you may feel like you're a woman. Anybody ever had a dream, a man, that you've become a woman in a dream? Any woman has ever had a dream that perhaps you've become a man? I know some people do. So it's we've had those opportunities. And so Shakespeare used to say that actually, because of this fact that everything is both a night dream and a day dream, everything in life is simply but a play. We're going through a particular role in this life. And in this life, our role is Bhakta Das, 6'5", 142 kilos. That's my role. I have to play that role. I have to, and I'm a devotee. And so this is that progress of coming out of that understanding that I'm not this material body, I'm not male, I'm not female, I'm a spirit soul. Now, in the past, unfortunately, within our society, women were exploited, and their positions on the basis of scripture were exploited. And when in fact they had no spiritual qualification, when the man has no spiritual qualification to lord it over anyone, they would lord it over some of the ladies in our movement, which was disastrous. This was not Prabhupada's move at all. He saw both men and women equally and said, you know, my disciples, my women disciples are as good as the men disciples. But unfortunately, some people took it that they were negative to our lady devotees. And consequently, what happened was a lot of the women at that stage were traumatized, abandoned, and suffered, you know, and some were actually even physically abused. And so this was a big, big setback to our movement. And the issue is that that has changed, obviously, with growth and with the advancement of people's consciousness and rising to spiritual consciousness. That's now changed. But the thing is that it was there in the past. And so the issue of women in the broader society is a huge issue at the moment. Everybody heard of the Me Too movement, where women have been abused? Has any of the ladies heard of the Me Too movement? The Me Too movement is where women are exploited by very wealthy people or influential people, and they get away with it. And they've gotten away with it for many, many generations. And now people are coming out and saying, how can you do this? You know? And so women are not being exploited anymore, and women are getting the strength to actually say, hey, hang on a tick, this is not right. There's a whole big case at the moment with some people that are royalty, even high up people. And so the thing is that women have been exploited over the years, and as such, society called on leaders to try and address this situation. Now, in ISKCON, we are the leaders spiritually. Now, people may not realize that completely at this point of time, but it is a fact. When you deal with different other faith traditions and stuff, we really have got such a wealth of knowledge that we can pass on to society. And Prabhupada said, actually, that the Krishna consciousness movement in the future will be the leaders of the world. And so this leadership is a thing. So the leaders in today's society, the materialistic leaders, are really promoting things like family violence programs, because there's statistics as far as violence against women is escalating. It's actually, I can't remember the exact, maybe you can, John, the exact proportion. I think it's something like one woman a week dies because of family violence. Some incredible amount.
The figures are high. It's never been, it's abuse against anybody has never been acceptable.
No.
Men or women.
Yeah.
Men are abused as well.
But it's a small fraction. Yeah. It's a small fraction. And women are actually dying because of family violence. So the leaders in today's society are saying enough is enough. And with sensitivity, they're trying to address people to come up to a level of understanding that, you know, everyone is equal and everybody has to work together. You know, and you cannot abuse just because you have a particular power. It's really interesting sometimes how a power shifts. And it's interesting. I heard recently that in the 17th century, men used to grow beards for the purpose of showing a woman that she couldn't do that. So it was like a sexual prowess thing, you know? So men would grow a beard and say, I'm the male, and that was linked to somehow their virility. So a man would grow a beard and say, look at me, you know? The funny thing is that women are also able to produce babies, which men can't do, so it's like, come on. So this was an interesting thing. So they made the analogy that growing a beard was like, you know how a peacock has its peacock fan? When it tries to attract a lady, it spreads out its peacock feathers and shapes around like this. So the beard somehow or other showed the lady, hey, look at me, baby, I'm really virile, you know.
Didn't work.
So anyway, it looks like nowadays also, you know, some more men, it seems like, and there's a trend, all of a sudden people are having beards and then they don't have beards and then they grow a beard again. At the moment, it's a bit of a trend to have a beard. And it's sort of like a status thing, you know, and who knows why. You know, sometimes people actually do these sort of things because they feel threatened by women. Because now women, if you take the point that actually men and women are equal, and they're as intelligent and competent as men, then, hey, hang on a tick, I'm losing my edge here. I'm much stronger. And so men become threatened, which is unfortunate. So anything that a religious institute presents in regards to women's rights, etc., is treated with suspicion. Hence, when we're dealing with the broader community, when we're dealing with other religions and stuff, this comes up. What is ISKCON's position on women? What is ISKCON's position? So we have to be really clear. So the suspicion is there sometimes, but suspicion is part of Kali Yuga. Nobody trusts anybody else. You know, the government's out to cheat me. This one is suspicious of that one. And it's the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And to counteract these effects, We strive to counteract them by developing Vaishnava relationships. Vaishnava relationships. Vaishnava relationships are based on Vedic knowledge. So you imprint this Vaishnava relationship on your intelligence. Vaishnava relationships. Vaishnava relationships are love and trust, which are both on faithfulness, loyalty, and chastity. So Vaishnava relationships is based on love, in that you love the Lord and you love His creation. You trust that the Lord will look after you in any situation. And then it's based on having faith in that, having faithfulness, and having loyalty, and also chastity, being chaste. So chastity to our vows of obedience to our guru, to our spiritual teacher. Having chastity for that, following clearly our guru and our gurus, our param gurus, our shiksha gurus, having chastity and the vows of obedience to Krishna, and having a chastity with other devotees, being chaste with other devotees, loving and respectful, but chaste. And if you have a life partner, being especially chaste and respectful to your life partner, you know, in marriage. Actually, it was really interesting when Bhakti and I got married. How many years ago, Bhakti? Over 41 years ago. And the spiritual master at that stage said, okay, your name is Bhaktidas and your wife's name is Bhakti Devi Dasi. And he turned to Bhakti and he said, and if he ever deviates from Krishna consciousness, you are to become like a tiger and bring him back. So I can't deviate, because Bhakti's a pretty powerful kid, you know. She'll just, if you hear her growl, and you think, oh boy, I better get back in line, you know. So this is the role of a man and a woman in marriage, that you support each other, that you work with each other. And if one is going off the rails a little bit, that is becoming a little bit too entangled to material sense gratification or whatever, it's the duty of the other person, whether male or female, to say, hey buddy, get back in line. So, and our guru said, you know, at that stage the spiritual teacher said, huh?
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, you'll have that relationship.
Well, it's not actually luck. There's no such thing as luck. We make our own luck. We make our own destiny. But if you pray to Krishna, and if you stay in this Vaishnava relationship mood, then you can actually develop it. So, there's that thing by Narottam Das Thakur. Hari Guru Vaishnava Bhagavata Gita. If we remember that verse alone, that thing will help us through our life. Hari Nam, Hari Guru Vaishnava Bhagavata Gita. They're the four principles that we should live by. We must be true to the scripture, right? To Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and any of the literature. Must be true to that. We must be true to Krishna himself, to Hari. Hari Guru Vaishnava. We must be true to Hari, Krishna, to the deity form of the Lord. Vaishnavas, we need the Vaishnavas in our lives. We need to have support of people that are like-minded. Hari Guru Vaishnava, Bhagavad Gita, Hari Nama, Bhagavad Gita, we need that. We need the support of the Vaishnavas. We must work together to be able to actually, birds of a feather flock together, they say. And so thereby we need that association. The material world actually is full of enticements at this present stage. It has never been so easy for people to go off the rails. In King Paranjana's time, in King Pratibhari's time, there were some principles still there. But today, I mean, for a devotee, there are so many enticements. I mean, we simply look on the internet. We simply drive in our cars. Do we simply watch the news or switch on a TV or go to a movie and we're enticed over and over and over again by demoniac forces that are actually encouraging us to live a sinful life. And so as devotees, somehow or other, we have to bring it back. And the best way to bring it back is to have that association with other devotees. To somehow or other stay close with other devotees. And you can have fun. You can do things, but just to understand that this person I'm associating with has principles, follows the Krishna conscious principles, and is also endeavoring for Vaishnava relationships, those qualities of love and trust and respect. So if that association is the most important when we're dealing with the relationship within marriage, within the person of the opposite sex, that relationship, we've chosen a relationship with someone for the rest of our life. And there's a level of intimacy and a level of association that's so intimate that you have to be on good terms with that situation for the rest of our lives. So that relationship also has to be based on Vaishnava relationships. Everything has to be done on a Vaishnava relationship. So Srila Prabhupada quotes, "The conclusion is that the material intelligence is the cause of bondage for this living entity." The material intelligence. This point is that one has to take spiritual intelligence to come out of this entanglement. So you encourage each other to get out of this material entanglement. Prabhupada then goes on to explain the story about Maharaj Ambarish. Maharaj Ambarish was a great devotee of the Lord. And he said, you have to be like Maharaj Ambarish. The last part of that purport was, Prabhupada was saying that you have to become like Maharaj Ambarish. Ambarish Maharaj, he walked to the temple, he smelled the flowers of Tulsi and the garlands, he saw the deities. His whole life was just captivated in Krishna consciousness. So this should also be our life. The story of Maharaj Ambarish is really good, and I just wanted to read out just to, for those that don't know the story of Maharaj Ambarish, this is the story of that great saint, saintly king. He was a king also, like Prachidabari. He was a king, but a king who was completely surrendered to Krishna. So, in our scriptures and epics, many interesting and colourful characters appear. One such character is Rishi Durvasa. Everybody heard of Durvasa Muni? Durvasa Muni was a great, powerful yogi. But he's always been a source of confusion for me. And it's one of those things that you sort of think, okay, well, maybe in the future I'll understand this. Because he was actually a part manifestation, or it's said that he was part manifestation of Lord Shiva. And he was a famous and glorious saint known for awesome powers of austerity and asceticism. But he also had this quality of being explosively angry. He could get angry really quickly. So I haven't met... I beg your pardon. My wife commented, something like you. No. That's why it's a perplexing thing for me. I'm a conditioned soul, Bhakti, but this is a great saintly person, you know. And this great saintly person, somehow or another, was still afflicted by anger. You know, he'd get angry at the drop of a hat. And everybody knew that. Oh, he's a great saint. Better. There were some sannyasis, actually, even in ISKCON, that people feared because they used to get angry. Anyway, we won't go there. But it was interesting. It used to be quite interesting. People would be. So Ambarish Maharaj was a king of the Ikshvaku dynasty. Anybody know what the Ikshvaku dynasty is? Can anybody tell me? Famous dynasty. Yes? Ram. Lord Ram. He was in that same dynasty, the Ikshvaku dynasty. Okay. So Maharaj Ambarish used to observe a codicil fast very religiously and rigorously. And his codicil fasting would begin on the previous evening itself. So he would start the codicil fast. On the evening prior to a codicil, he would partake only in fruits and milk and fast for the whole next day at a codicil and break his fast according to the regulations at the right time early in the morning of Dwadasi, the following codicil. Okay? So now, if the fast is not broken at the proper time on Dwadasi morning, the entire codicil fasting is considered invalid. This is for a previous age. Remember this. We're lucky if we can get through a whole day and fast, you know, on a codicil. And Prabhupada never made that big a deal about breaking fast exactly on that time or you'll lose all the potency of your codicil. So we're not that much worried about it. And again, Prabhupada is so amicable that he could work that sort of for us. But anyway, here we had Maharaj Ambarish, who was a powerful yogi, powerful personality. So, even Indra, the king of the demigods, was shaken by the power of his fast. Always anxious about losing his throne to a more worthy candidate, an edgy Indra requested sage Durvasa to visit Ambarish, hoping that the visit would somehow or other cause trouble for Ambarish. So here they go, they're plotting. You know, I'll get this guy out of here, you know. So, Durvasa Muni arrived at Ambarish Maharaj's palace in the wee hours of the morning of Dwadasi, when the time to break the Ekadasi fast was close. The sage came with hundreds of disciples, because he was so popular, it was thousands. He informed the king that he and his disciples were heading to the river and they would be back after ablutions, and requested adequate arrangements be made for their repast. So have something ready for us when we're coming back. Make sure you've got some yummies, some prasadam for our group. So Maharaj Ambarish was in a quandary. Holding the sage in high regard and well aware of his famous temper, the king gave instructions for the preparation of a sumptuous meal and waited for the sage's return. However, Durvasa Muni was delayed. The sage, who loved to test people, deliberately tarried at the river, knowing that the time of breaking fast was at hand. As the time for breaking fast arrived, Maharaj Ambarish consulted his royal guru and other priests, and taking their advice, made an offering to the devas and kept the part aside for Durvasa Muni. So he did the right thing. He was very important. He wanted to leave, but he then proceeded to sip a little water as a token of breaking the fast and continued to wait for the sage. So he thought, I'll just sip a little bit of water and then wait for the sage. But he'd done his duty and broken the fast. Durvasa, on his return, was enraged to find that the king had not waited for him and he was being given a part of what was already offered to the devas. What the hell is going on here? He was very upset. In anger, Durvasa Muni created a demon called... Can anybody remember? I couldn't remember. Can anybody remember the demon that Durvasa... Any scholars here that can remember? Kritya was a really demonic. I mean, if you see some of the demoniac creatures that they have on television and on video nowadays, this guy was just the epitome. You know, he was just like... Rah. So he was a fearsome demon and ordered him to slay the king. So here this demon comes out. Okay, slay the king. Kritya charged forward to Ambarish and to attack him. Ambarish Maharaja was absolutely, as Prabhupada has pointed out in his purport, was absolutely surrendered to the Lord, and simply joined the palms of his hands, and fixing his mind on Lord Sri Hari, he prayed for his grace. Here is a classic example for all of us. When the monsters of material life come to attack us, when the monsters and the demons of the material connections come to attack us, come to attack our mind, like Maharaj here, he surrendered, simply joining, fixing his mind and intelligence on Krishna, and he just allowed whatever, prayed for his grace. My Lord, I'm your servant. Sri Hari invoked his infallible weapon, the Sudarshan Chakra, which instantly destroyed Kritya. And the chakra then started chasing. Who did it start to chase after that?
Durvasa
Muni. So they got this... And Durvasa Muni is going, oh no! And he starts running and running and running and running. And then he finally, I've got no place to run. So he runs to see Lord Brahma. He had that power to actually go to Lord Brahma's abode. So he goes to Lord Brahma. Mara, there's the Sudarshan Chakra is chasing me. He said, I can't do anything about the Sudarshan Chakra. You'll have to go and see Lord Shiva. We did this play too, actually. This, now I remember it. We did this play as well. So then he run, and he goes to see Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva's sitting there very peacefully meditating. And Durvasa comes up. You have to protect me. The Sudarshan Chakra is about to destroy me. And Lord Shiva says, I can't do anything. You'll have to go to Hari. You'll have to go to Vishnu. So he runs and runs and runs. So how powerful is this Durvasa that he can actually see these personalities? This is what was always perplexing for me. And then he goes to Vishnu, and Vishnu says, I can't protect you. Yes, it's my Sudarshan Chakra, but you've offended a devotee. And consequently, you have to go to the devotee to seek... Hare Krishna, welcome. You have to come to... You have to seek the devotee. Forgiveness. And that's the only thing that will stop this Sudarshan Chakra. So finally, Durvasa ran back to Ambarish Maharaj, fell at his lotus feet and said, please forgive me. I didn't understand the great personality that you are. I should never have acted in this way. And Durvasa Muni and Ambarish Maharaj had no hassle at all in forgiving Durvasa Muni. So this is the great sign of a great devotee. When we're being... if you can imagine, this person was trying to do the best for this sage, and then the sage turns around and wants to kill him. And yet he just turned around and said, forgive you. Now, so throughout all history, we've seen that great saintly people can forgive. Even the most heinous attack at them, they can forgive. Just by they have the grace that I'm surrendered to the Lord. Whatever the Lord wants to do with me is fine. Again, understanding that this is simply a play that we're in here. And this act of the play is where the drama happens, where I'm threatened with my life. And so in the response to that, Ambarish Maharaj said, sure, I'll forgive you. Great personalities have always been like that. Haridas Thakur, when he was beaten in 21 marketplaces. And you know, in the end, you know, they said, why don't you just die? You know, the dacoits or those guards that were beating him, why don't you just die? Oh, you want me to do that? Okay. And he forgave them. Similarly, in the great story of our Guru, Lord Jesus Christ, where they nailed him to a cross, and he turned around and said, forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they're doing. So this, in the play of life, there are going to be instances where we have to be able to forgive, because the monsters that were trying to destroy us, destroy our Krishna consciousness, destroy our life, it's all just a play. But the point is here that Ambarish Maharaj fully surrendered to Krishna. Whatever happens, Krishna is fine. So the point of it is, the last part, Rishi Durvasa learned that day that never, ever harass a devotee of Krishna. Never, ever harass a devotee of Krishna. This is the point. So you have to say that sometimes if you're being harassed, or sometimes... I remember even on Harinams in the early 70s and 80s, we used to be harassed all the time. Excuse me, you guys. There's a class on. We were harassed all the time. All the time. People would try and beat us up. People would try and do things to us. I was one of the people that used to guard the ladies at the back. Only because I'm tall. You know, at that stage I was skinny also, believe it or not. I was a skinny guy, but the temple president said, well, you're sort of tall, so stand at the back and guard the women. I said, well, I'm not competent to do anything. But so anyway, that was my role. And every time we went on Harinam, there was this one person who hated me. And every time he saw that I was out on Harinam, he would come out of the pub and he would spit on me. Every single time. And again. And then we'd come around again and again. You know, oh, God. Every time, bhakti, got another curta. We've got to wash that one. Dirty, you know. But I had to forgive this guy. You know, this is the message. This was the part of the play which I was in, that here was an attack, you know. And similarly, we have also in our life, we're going to be afflicted by the monsters of illnesses, sicknesses, everything is coming to us. When we're dealing with chaplaincy, we just saw that some of our devotees here, one of our dear devotees also, is afflicted with an illness. This is again part of the play of our life. And what does that devotee do? Simply surrendering to Krishna. Like Ambarish Maharaj, absolutely, pray for Krishna's grace. My Lord, I don't know how this play is playing out, whether this is the last chapter of my play, but whatever it is, Let me just surrender to your lotus feet. So this is the thing. So the point is, never harass a devotee of Krishna. So this can also be applied to our relationships with one another. Never harass a devotee of Krishna. So if we're harassing our wives or we're harassing our husbands, we're harassing a devotee of Krishna. So somehow or other we have to be very tolerant and have a very nice Vaishnava relationship. Remember the Vaishnava relationship? Is one of love and trust, chastity, like that. So everyone has to become 100% devoted to Lord Krishna in all that we do in life and have appreciation that everything is part of the Lord's creation. This is the Lord's manifestation. And as such, as part of the Lord, we must honour every aspect of the Lord. Krishna speaks about his energies in Bhagavad Gita, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego, all these eight constitute my separated material energies. Out of the earth, water, fire, these are the gross material energies. The other three, mind, intelligence, and ego, are the subtle energies. And apart from these, Krishna says, besides these, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is another, a superior energy of mine, which comprises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. So we are all prisoners stuck in this material. Our play is that of a prisoner in this captive world, right? And somehow or other we have to play the part and work our way out of this play. And the way we get out of this play is full surrender to Krishna. The superior energy is the Jivatma, a Jivatma, which is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. That's our real position. Through the soul, though the soul is part of Krishna, it is temporarily covered. We're covered in this illusion by these eight elements. The soul, in actual fact, is part of God. And that part of God is looking for the ecstasy to be with God. Not to be God, but to be with God. That is the real ecstasy. And when the soul forgets its relationship with God, it tries to look for pleasure through the ego and the intelligence. Really interesting, you know, and we're so fooled by it. The soul searches out for something to enjoy, you know. The ear is constantly searching out, what can I hear that's nice? So many different things, and we're bombarded. And the mind, you know, first the senses come into it, right? So we're driving around or we're on the internet, and all of a sudden we see a picture that's enticing. It could be some food, it could be another person, and all of a sudden the mind goes, oh, look at this. And then the allurements of today are everywhere. So then the senses, then the mind goes, oh, you could enjoy that. And then the intelligence has to kick in. And that's where Krishna conscious intelligence comes in. Because the intelligence then relates that situation and says, hang on a tick, yes, there may be pleasure, but there may also be pain. So from Vedic knowledge, from Krishna conscious knowledge, we say, hang on, I don't want to be a part of that. An analogy that's given, it's like a razor blade covered with honey, right? So the mind goes, the senses go, honey, I like honey. You know, there used to be the bear, Yogi Bear. Ah, you guys know. Now, some of you may say it. Yogi Bear was always addicted to honey. You go, ooh, honey, I like honey. So anyway, if you can imagine this razor blade with honey on it. So the senses go, honey. Mind goes, yeah. Honey, you like honey. You want to have honey. But your intelligence goes, hang on a tick, that's a razor blade. If I go and lick this, I'm going to get hurt. My tongue is going to get cut. So it's not the best idea to do. If we don't listen to that good intelligence, what's going to happen? You're going to cut your tongue. You may get a little, oh, yum! Right? So we have to listen to our intelligence, our good intelligence. Our bad intelligence may say, yes, that's okay. You'll get the pleasure of the honey, and there may be a little cut, but the wound will heal very quickly. There has to be pleasure, there has to be pain. How often have we heard that in the material world? There's a little bit of pleasure, but for every little pleasure, there's pain. If there wasn't pain, how could you appreciate happiness? That's that Faust coming up. You know, the devil. So many people say, Oh, you know, I did this action because the devil made me do it. Some other outside force made me do it. And actually, that devil comes up. That devil is material intelligence. The devil is the mind, our own mind, and our senses. Our senses are saying, yeah, we want to enjoy. We want to enjoy. You know? And then the mind goes, yes, you can enjoy this and that. And material intelligence says, don't worry about it. Happiness is distress. You may be a little bit happy now, but later, you know, there might be some distress, but that's not a big deal. Yes, you're going to grow old, but you're going to grow old happy. And you'll be in an old people's home, but it'll be a lovely old people's home. And when you pass away, it won't be that bad. Believe me, it's not like that. People suffer like anything at the time of death. And without spiritual knowledge, without the grace that Maharaj Ambarish had, surrendering everything to Krishna when death was coming, you are lost. And your intelligence will fail you. You've sold your soul to the devil. And you again have to come back to this material world. Again and again and again. Next act, next play, this time. Well, my friend, you were in such a nice human male body in this one. Next lifetime, we'll give you a lovely body of a woman. You were so negative, and you were also so, was thinking so much about women. Here we go. You try a woman's body for a change. And then in that part of the play, you have to then act as a woman. But we are not men. We are not women. We're not black. We're not white. We are spirit souls, jivatma. And we've got to get out of this. So play the game. Now there's another thing as far as the game is concerned. The acting, the play, the whole scenario that we're in. And we're all in this. You're the cast of millions in my play. And I'm part of your play. So the thing is, there's another trick that we do in acting. The actor has to become... What is it they say? What is it that they say again? Act it until you are it. Right?
Fake it till you make it.
Fake it till you make it. That's what I'm after. Thanks, John. I'm glad you're in the class, mate. You're such a help. Fake it until you make it. So the intelligence will tell you, fake it. Be Krishna conscious. Have a Vaishnava relationship. And you say, well, I'm not a pure devotee, Prabhu, I'm not. Don't worry about it. Fake it till you make it. Just be loyal. Be chaste. Be respectful. Be trusting. Be loving. Use your intelligence. And the intelligence with Krishna conscious knowledge will entice you to follow through. And then all of a sudden, by playing this game, fake it till you make it, then all of a sudden you are not anymore attached to this material body. You are not anymore connected to this material body. And you're home free even while you're in this material body. And it's all by the grace of His divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, and the Vedic teachings. Go back home. Finish this cycle of birth and death. This is our duty. Finish this play acting. Don't be part of the night and day dream anymore. Just go back home. And be enticed by the message of the Shastra, by the message of the great teachers, you know, that this is not worth our while to stay here. We have a far greater opportunity for enjoyment and spiritual enjoyment in a Vaishnava relationships. And so especially, take shelter of Hari Guru Vaishnava, Bhagavata Gita. Take shelter of that. And in this difficult world, there, as I said, there are so many enticements. And to have equal Vaishnava friend in your life, an equal Vaishnava friend in your life, in Krishna consciousness, in a Krishna conscious marriage, is of the greatest benefit. Those of you that are not strong enough to take up the role of a single person as a sannyasi, to actually have that spiritual Vaishnava equal relationship with a Vaishnava partner is the greatest benefit, because one will help the other. Oh, I'm down a little bit, I'll pick you up. Oh, you're down a bit? I'll pick you up. Working together. Working together. When one is going off the path a little bit too much, then become like a tiger and say, hey, get back in line, fella. Stay Krishna conscious. Don't lose the point. So fake it until you make it. Can we do that? Remember, it's an act. Okay? We wake up in the morning, and as an actor, we've come out of one play, our dream, and that's been really surreal and really freaky and all that kind of stuff. And you are 100% into that dream, correct? You can't remember the body that's lying back in the bed. So now you wake up in the morning, you're shaking off, you're moving to the next play. This is the day play, the daydream. And there you are in the mirror. Uh-huh, this is the body I've got, okay, hair is right, lipstick is on, da-da-da. Let's go. But we act in a Krishna conscious way. We use our intelligence in a Krishna conscious way. In a Krishna conscious way, we control our mind, we control our sense gratification, and we do everything for the service of Krishna, and we associate with like-minded people. That's our part. Any comments or questions at all, Prabhu? Yes, Prabhu?
Just comment about, like, you were talking about the positions of the women in the society, so just a thought came in my mind. Like, I was listening to lectures, so they mentioned, like, in any government, there are the three main key departments, like the defense, the finance, and the education department.
Mm-hmm.
In Krishna government, all three key portfolio are being held by the women. So, defense is the Durga Devi, finance is the Lakshmi Devi, and the education is the Saraswati Devi. So.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. And the most important one is which? Money. Money. And Draupadi was a classic example of that. You know, she was actually the power behind the Pandavas. Draupadi was the power behind the Pandavas. She controlled everything. She controlled the money. All the Pandavas had to come to her and say, can we do this? I said, no, we can't do that. Can we run the kingdom like that? No, you can't do that. Yes, you can do that. And generally speaking, in most households, but it can flex variable, a woman is far more frugal with money, generally speaking, in this lifetime. But it varies, you know. Like, I carry over something from my female body in past lives, and in that I like cooking. So it's all varies. It's all different like that. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhuji.
Sometimes you feel very fired up in devotional studies.
Mm-hmm.
Other times you're too low. They're waxing and waning.
Mm.
So why is so much waxing and waning, even in devotional studies?
Yeah, material energy. Material energy. As I said, we are captured. We are prisoners. And we have to constantly remember that. We have to constantly remember we are prisoners, and we have to train our intelligence to become Krishna conscious intelligence. You know? And it's the intelligence that will override the senses, the mind, the ego. It's the intelligence. But if your intelligence is in material consciousness, and it will happen, we are conditioned for lifetimes. We have had so many plays. We've been in so many movies. You know, life movies, that we can't even remember the last one we're in, but we are always acting. And in this lifetime, you're acting as the doctor, now you're a senior person, you have to wear glasses, you're living in here and there. But you have to remember, I'm not. I'm actually a spirit soul. And then you have to be like, I'm Barish Maharaj. Everything. How are my eyes being used in Krishna's service? And sometimes people think the only way I can be Krishna conscious is if I'm here at the temple. Not so easy. Krishna's everywhere. The deities are there. Vaishnavas are here. But then when I get home, you have to make your home. Prabhupada said you have to make your home a temple. That everywhere you look, you see Krishna. Not that we have to have mundane pictures everywhere. We can have beautiful landscape paintings if it reminds you of Krishna. If you can watch a documentary, like, say, for example, at the present stage, I'm watching a documentary by David Attenborough, the seven countries, or I think it's seven continents. which he analyzes all the different life forms in a particular continent. Well, you can look at that in a material way, or you can look at it in a spiritual way, using spiritual intelligence. And you go, my God, Krishna is so beautiful. He's such an artist. He's so creative. Look at this little guy that was this little lizard thing, you know? And it looked like the most outrageous-looking little creature, no bigger than this. And the way it absorbs water, it stands in the water, ugly as anything. It had horns everywhere, ugly as anything. It stands in the water and it sucks up the water through its legs. Things like that, and you think Krishna's so amazing. So amazing. So you have to see everything tinged with the eye of Shastra, Shastra Chakshush. So if you have that, and you have to constantly remind yourself, it's not worth worrying about, this is the material world. And these demons like Kritja are coming at me all the time. You know? And recognize it, and then surrender to Krishna. Does that make sense?
So you want to say anarthas. Anarthas,
which are putting us down, up and down. Anarthas. Yeah. And they'll come. We're conditioned for lifetimes, millions of lifetimes. One stage you were that little lizard going. One stage you were that fly that was flying around. And this is one thing I wanted to mention, actually, while I'm thinking of this. How wonderful Krishna's creation is. And we may watch a David Attenborough documentary and think, wow, this is amazing, you know. But sometimes I've even seen devotees, and this really irritates me like anything, you know, where a devotee is agitated by a mosquito or a little fly and goes, oh, like this. Not thinking. Have a look, if you put this little fly under a microscope, how incredibly this thing is constructed, this living entity is constructed. And there's a Jivatma in there, and there's Krishna in this little fly. How dare you destroy that? How dare you? Everywhere we go, we're increasing our karma just by breathing. If you're not Krishna conscious, you're creating karma. Be akarma. Don't do anything that is going to disrupt or disturb Krishna's creation. And we can't help it. If we've offered yoga to the Lord, you know, there's a culture in there, there are living entities in there that we're eating. But we have to first offer everything to Krishna. Again, like Maharaj Ambarish, thinking all the time about Krishna. That's our role. But I can't stand that when devotees do that. It's just like, are you for real? Don't you understand that that's what you're doing? You were once that little fly. And some people find this really hard to understand. You were once that little fly. In your 8,400,000 species of life, you've been through it. Now you have this human intelligence. An animal can't use its locked into material intelligence. It hasn't got free will to switch, to put the switch. I choose Krishna consciousness. I choose devotion. That's only the domain of a devotee, of a human. A human has that opportunity to see everything in relationship to Krishna, to hear everything in relationship to Krishna. Like recently, I came across, you know, in my past, I was really attracted to a songwriter called Leonard Cohen, you know. And for some reason or other, I got to listen to one of his songs. Now, when I was a karmi, when I was a non-devotee, I listened and I had no thought of it. But then, this time I listened to this song called Lover, 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 Come Back to Me. Now, when I was a non-devotee, I thought he's talking about some girlfriend that he had. Lover, 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 come back to me. It's not. He was talking about Krishna. He was talking about God. If you listen to the words of that song in a devotional mind, you hear that actually I left you for so long. I turned my back on you. But you keep telling me, lover, 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 come back to me. And that's so powerful. Krishna's calling us back. You are the lover of Krishna. Krishna is your lover. And he's pleading with us. Lover, 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 come back to me. So whether Leonard Cohen actually meant it to that depth, from a Krishna conscious point of view, using Krishna conscious intelligence, that's how I read it. And it inspired me Krishna consciously. I've visualized Krishna calling out to me, Bhakta, lover, 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 come back to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Another comment, probably. Yes, Nanda?
This is a question. You were mentioning about fake it till make it in spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
So how far can one take this fake it to make it?
Lord
Rishabh, that he mentioned in the fifth canto, that one should not become a father, a mother, a spiritual master, or even a worshipable God. One cannot deliver one's dependence from the cycle of God's death. And we also see in Krishna consciousness, there's been a lot of gurus, sannyasis So how, especially in preaching, how far can one take this point?
You always have to have the checks and balances of your brothers and sisters, your association. And if you're becoming... The question was, is that I mentioned in the class, fake it till you make it. And some devotees may have in the past faked it to such an extent that they weren't really there and have left. Well, that's possible for all of us. But when that person was acting in good Krishna conscious power, it was just as valid. Say, for example, I've got a classic example. I'm not going to mention any names, but this devotee had the most beautiful Sankirtan voice, right? And he put out so many... He was a guru. And then he fell away in a horrible way. Yet, when... And some devotees said, well, I won't listen to that person's songs anymore. But yet, when you hear the songs that he sang at that time, he was faking it until he make it, right? He was sincerely trying to be as Krishna conscious as he could. And even I hear that song that he sings now, it's inspiring to me. Even though the personality at that time is not the same personality that it is now, at that time, it made all the difference. So, again, you'll have checks and balances as well. You have also people that perhaps act like a pure devotee. And we used to call that PD syndrome, pure devotee syndrome, where I'm so pure. It's a false ego. So it's not really faking till you make it, because if you really, you have to follow through and just be Krishna conscious. So that also means you have to be humble, you have to not be influenced by the ego. It's a difficult acting job, I'll tell you. You can't really fake it till you make it, you really have to work at it. And when you work at it, you're Krishna conscious. Does that answer your question a little bit? Okay, thanks Prabhu. Yes Prabhu.
On the same point of faking till you make it, how do we know who is faking and who is making?
Does it make any difference?
If I'm faking or I'm making it.
Does it make any difference? If someone is encouraging you spiritually, if someone is inspiring you spiritually, whether they're there or they're not there, does it make any difference to you? If you see someone being loving, if you see someone being truthful, if you see someone being respectful, if someone's really trying to be Vaishnav, you know, And in their heart they still have so many material desires, but they're trying the hardest they can. Does it make any difference to you? You just become inspired by them, by their loving relationship. If it's not based on false ego, and you're intuitive as well. There's Chaita Guru within. And Chaita Guru within will tell you, intuitively you'll know, oh, this guy's faking it. There's some ego there. But if it's genuine, he's trying to follow and be a Krishna conscious devotee, and he's a good actor, won me over. God, so what the hell's, what's wrong with that? That's a wonderful thing. If it's inspiring and increasing your Krishna consciousness, that's great. Does it make sense? Yes, Pajon?
When we look at fake it till we make it is the destination, but the fake it can be more important because that's the journey.
You got it. Exactly. You got the message, yes. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much, Prabhu. Again, Nanda Mandir, thank you very much for allowing me to give the class, Prabhu. I owe you one. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Yatra Srinath Bhagavatam ki. Govinda Prema Nandi.